From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, on the eve of a special election for Montana's only House seat, the Republican candidate Greg Gianforte allegedly assaulted a reporter asking about the GOP health care bill.
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last time you came here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here.
It's the latest in a string of incidents of journalists getting roughed up while reporting on the government, and it's raising fresh concerns about the treatment of journalists in the Trump era, politicians, and the press. Next on Forum, after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. On the eve of Montana's special election, Greg Gianforte, the Republican candidate for Congress, was charged with physically assaulting Ben Jacobs, a reporter for The Guardian, who was asking him a question about the GOP health care bill. Audio of the incident and an eyewitness account by Fox News reporters led to the misdemeanor assault charge, even though Gianforte's campaign attempted to blame the incident on, quote, aggressive behavior from a liberal journalist. Last night, Gianforte won Montana's only House seat and ultimately apologized in his acceptance speech. But the incident is renewing concerns about a poisonous media climate in the Trump era. Wednesday's event is the latest in a string of disturbing incidents between journalists and government officials. Last week, for example, Federal Communications Commission security pinned a reporter to the wall after he tried to ask FCC commissioners a question. And before that, West Virginia police arrested a reporter for trying to question Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price in the state capitol. Joining us for the hour to look at the relationship between media and government are Brooke Gladstone. She's host and managing editor of On the Media from WNYC Studios, and her new book is The Trouble with Reality. Good morning, Brooke Gladstone.
Good morning.
We're also joined by David French, senior fellow at the National Review Institute and a senior writer for the National Review. Good morning, David French.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And thanks also to Tom Rosensteel for being here, executive director of the American Press Institute and author of the novel Shining City. Good morning, Tom Rosensteel.
Hi, good to be with you.
I'd like to just establish at the outset, Tom Rosensteel, that journalists are pushy. I mean, we're badgering. We can be intimidating even when we're surrounding a politician at a time when he or she would much rather be anywhere else, right?
Well, I think they some are when they have to be. I don't think that that is the posture of all journalists in all settings. The goal is to get people to answer questions, to get information, and the purpose of that is we can't really have a democracy unless the information that's held by a few is transparent to the sovereign. You know, the people who vote and who hold power. You know, the people who, in a democracy, the people need to have information to be able to be self-governing. So journalists are the bridge for that. If you are rude all the time, it can be counterproductive. But when a politician is eluding you and it's required to be pushy, then that's the tool you should use.
Essentially, Brooke Gladstone, what Tom Rosensteel is saying is that, yes, these tensions are in some ways baked in, right? They're designed to exist because journalists will have several instances where they will push tough questions that elected officials or candidates, in the case of Greg Gianforte, would rather avoid.
Right. It's not only baked in, it also ebbs and flows. I mean, there was a fantastic piece just in the Washington Post today about essentially reporters having to defend themselves against knives and prison in Washington from practically the beginning of the republic. And so this has always gone on, but obviously there have been more poisonous moments for the media than others. I mean, remember that people were denied their freedom of expression in the Bush years as well. If they wore T-shirts saying things that didn't appeal to the Bush administration or the officials appearing at the events, those people would be taken away. They might even have been, in some cases, arrested. But this is almost unprecedented. I mean, and the assaults on the press began during Trump's campaign, not just calling them horrible people, illegitimate people, scum. At one point, he said in Grand Rapids, "I would never kill him, but I do hate him." And he also encouraged violence at his rallies. This is all on tape. So, and what's even more important is that he has done something that is almost unprecedented, and that is to say that, and that is to attempt to delegitimize the very mission of a free press. And that is something we haven't ever seen in this way, as far as I know, ever in American history.
So it sounds like you're saying then, Brooke Gladstone, that you don't think this act, say, by Greg Gianforte, where he body slammed a reporter who was asking him a very routine question about the GOP healthcare bill, that you don't see that as just sort of a wacky aberration. You see it as part of the much bigger climate that's being created by the hostile tone and rhetoric from our president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the physical altercation, that's maybe a little bit wacky. But what it implies says everything about the environment that we're in.
David French, what's your take on this in terms of Greg Gianforte's behavior and whether it plays into a bigger cultural context?
Well, I think the action of the individual congressman, I think it's hard to draw any conclusions from that other than, meaning, you know, in 2010, there was a Democratic congressman who grabbed a student reporter by the throat who was being pushy towards him. There's, you know, this kind of thing is, you know, anytime you have a group of people in Congress, over time, you're going to have some real characters and some bad actors in there. My concern, although I think nobody can defend what Gianforte or can credibly defend what Gianforte did, my concern isn't so much with that one incident, which law enforcement can and should handle. My concern is with the avalanche of justifications or whataboutism that followed it. In other words, people saying, for example, in the right-wing Twitter sphere, that saying or implying that what he did was manly, which is just absurd, or the notion that says, well, I don't have to deal with or grapple with what Gianforte did because look at left-wing violence that's out there as well. And that whataboutism, I think, is particularly alluring to a lot of people because it allows them to not exactly excuse what Gianforte did but not grapple with it. And the problem is, accountability doesn't come from the other side in American politics. Accountability only comes from your own team. Mm. And if your own team is not calling its own members to account for bad behavior, they'll never be called to account. And that's a real problem.
Interesting. And this whataboutism is unique to you? It's in its tenor or its volume?
Well, it's increasing. I mean, whataboutism has always been with us.
Right.
I mean, it's a common deflection or misdirection from an accusation of misconduct to go, well, what about this other guy who also did something similar? Why don't you condemn him too? That's very common. It happens on both sides of the political spectrum, but it is rampant now. And I think it's a product of our increasing negative polarization. In other words, negative polarization means that we're on the side that we're on, not so much because we like our own side's ideas, but because we hate or fear the other side so darn much. And that is rampant, and that makes us much less likely to call out our own side because that's perceived as weakness. That's perceived as giving the hated other side an opening or an opportunity that at all costs we can't let them have.
And Tom Rosenstiel, you know, jumping off what David French is saying, it was very interesting, right, that Gianforte's defense initially, before he then later apologized during his acceptance speech after victory, was that he made a point that it was a, quote, liberal journalist, or he described Ben Jacobs in that way, which points to a context that this was politically motivated in some way.
Yeah, that's particularly unfortunate. I mean, I agree with David. I think that, you know, there's a lot of hatred in both sides. You see it in social media that animates sort of the wings of both parties. It makes it extremely difficult for people to come together. And the press, as an agent of information, that creates a public square where people can have a common set of facts and begin to solve problems is an important part of this, of this sort of a common space where we can be civil with each other and come to terms. So Jean Forte's notion that some keep continuing to suggest that because The Guardian is a liberal publication, that this offers some justification or explanation for his criminal behavior, allegedly criminal behavior, you know, that's particularly disturbing. You know, the Obama administration was very rough on reporters. They didn't beat them up, but they used criminal threats against reporters in ways that were in some ways unprecedented. The notion that you want to suppress a vibrant press is typical of anyone in power. They don't like leaks. They don't want to be examined. They would rather operate with more seclusion. And what you have in over the last 20 years is a growing sentiment that the press, the mainstream press in the United States, is liberal and unfair to conservatives, and to somehow hitch your wagon to that to defend the physical abuse or the legal abuse of the press is a distortion. You can make an argument that the press is that too much of the press is liberal, and that has nothing to do with any threats against press freedom or against journalists personally. There's an ends justifies the means element to this, which is very disturbing and is also not something that belongs to one side or the other.
Tom Rosenstiel, he is executive director of the American Press Institute. We're also talking with David French, senior fellow at the National Review Institute and a senior writer for the National Review, and with Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media from WNYC. And her new book is The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. I want to just dissect for a little bit the Trump effect, just because it has been brought up. Not just by you, Brooke Gladstone, by a lot of people who feel like the rhetoric from the president has created hostility toward the press to a degree where people may feel less like they have to control their behaviors when they're around journalists. What could you just talk a little bit more about the Trump effect and what you think it's had on our media climate?
Sure. I mean, we've had lots of talk about new norms or maybe return to old norms from the beginning of the Republic. But I think it's important perhaps not to separate out the press's situation from the expression of speech in general. It is certainly true that there are disruptors on the left, the so-called Antifa, that go in with the absolute intention of disrupting an event. And they are fine with creating altercations and dust-ups. But the fact is, and I go back to the Trump campaign, he was offering a new kind of license to the people in his sphere, his supporters. You know, he would, as protesters were being removed from a St. Louis rally, he complained how long it was taking to get them out. He said the country needed to toughen up. He said, you know, part of the problem and part of the reason it takes so long is nobody wants to hurt anybody anymore. When people were, when a couple of Boston men beat up a Mexican immigrant, he said the attack was a shame. But then he said, I will say that people who are following me are very passionate. They love this country and they want this country to be great again. So he combines, he sees this kind of violence, or he excuses it as just something that comes from the depth of passion. And we do know from the Southern Poverty Law Center that incidents of violence have risen in the run-up to and after the election against people who may not sign on to the Trump train. And so this is worrisome, not just for reporters, but for everybody's speech.
Well, let me play a clip of President Trump last month talking about the media at a rally marking his 100 days in office. This is not as incendiary as the ones that you mentioned during his campaign, but notable nonetheless.
If the media's job is to be honest and tell the truth, then I think we would all agree the media deserves a very, very big, fat failing grade.
So there's this aspect of it where there's this sort of support of passion protesters who behaved aggressively or violently. There's talking about the media as being totally dishonest. And then there's this other aspect of it, David French, where he's not commenting at all after an egregious event. So, for example, a White House spokesperson said that President Trump had no comment on the altercation between Gianforte and Jacobs. He had no comment, say, for example, when Erdogan's bodyguards beat up protesters either. What is the effect of both these overt statements that do you think these tacit it feels like tacit approval. So do you think these no comments, I guess, are just as powerful as these overt statements?
Well, I don't know if they're just as powerful. I would say, so Trump has been drawn to these authoritarian personalities. I mean, the comments that he's made praising the leader of the Philippines who's sanctioning vigilante murder and who claims to have actually murdered people. I mean, going all the way back years ago, his very strange and disturbing comments about Tiananmen Square. And this is a guy who has long expressed open admiration for some pretty darn thuggish personalities. Here's my concern, though. So Trump is a politician. He will eventually go away from the scene. My concern is not so much that Trump is leading a charge or stoking a resentment as much as he is maybe reflecting it, and that there is a large groundswell of people in this country who fundamentally have this rage and hatred towards a free press. And by extension, and let's make no mistake, I mean, this is by extension fundamentally a rage and hatred against the very notion of the First Amendment and free expression itself. And that is something that I think took a lot of people by surprise when Trump rose, was this notion, wait a minute, he's actually not just leading, he's reflecting something that exists. And that's something that we have to grapple with as a society, as a culture. It's easy to go, oh, Donald Trump, let's get rid of Donald Trump, and then things will go back to the way they were. I think instead what we need to say is Donald Trump revealed something that's deeper than Donald Trump that has to be dealt with. And one of those things is this incredibly visceral hatred that exists amongst millions of Americans for the media. And in many ways, look, there are members of the media who are dishonest, just like there are members of every profession that are dishonest. I'm a lawyer. I mean, who despises lawyers? You know, we're probably more despised than the media. But is the media out there?
Actually, I don't think so. Not at the moment.
but Tom Rosenstiel, what David French is alluding to is that the standing of the press has been declining for years, and it was declining before Trump really came in as a central figure against the media. Why do you think that is? Tom Rosenstiel, are you there? Oh, I think we may have lost you. But yeah, Brooke
question.
Gladstone. What do you think is behind that?
I'm a radio person. I'm sensitive to dead time. I think that what Tom would probably say is 40 years of think tanks and actually a strategy that was hit upon probably around the time of the Nixon administration that created the sense that the media could not be honest brokers because they were mostly liberal. Now, what we've seen to counterbalance that, let us assume for the purposes of this conversation, and I don't think it's an outlandish notion, that people who are attracted to journalism do tend to be more liberal. Does that undermine automatically their fairness or their probity. In fact, they're so conscious of this charge that many have noticed a tendency towards false balance. There have been studies about the coverage of presidents, and Reagan and Bush were covered far better than Clinton, and of course Obama got solid coverage, but really no better than, say, Bush, and in fact far less good coverage in Fox, which was emergent at that point. So, you know, you have this notion, which may or may not be true, it automatically extends to the coverage, which I don't think has been liberal. I think if the media have a bias, it's a status quo bias. It's a bias to keep things more or less the way they are, moving slowly. The media have a financial imperative to keep pace with the American people, the backlash, and then the lash, the move forward, the move back, not to get too far ahead, not to go too far behind. This is also the commercial bias, you might say. So, but in the times of such incredible polarization, there's a great difference between how Democrats regard the mainstream media and how Republicans do. Although, let me just say that there is an interesting study that suggests the two lowest ranked institutions in our country are actually Congress and big business. The media come just above that. At the top of the list is the military, followed by small business. So, you know, on another show, we can chew over that.
Well, let me get our listeners' take on our media climate. You can join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, post your comments on Facebook, on Twitter, or at our website, kqed.org/forum. This listener wants to know, can one of your guests please define the media? Are we talking about a few highly funded TV and radio companies, independent journalists, bloggers, special interest groups, government propaganda? I think that it's such an interesting question, in part because I think it contributes to why the standing of the press has been declining for years. Now, Tom Rosenstiel, we're talking about what may be contributing to this media decline.
Right.
And one of the things has been, some people have pointed to the decentralization of the news, that there are a lot more stories out there, a lot more information that doesn't get vetted or the way that sort of traditional news media organizations do that, which are news. Do you think that has played a role?
Yeah, I mean, there's two elements to this. One is that we began to see the declines in trust in media starting in the 1980s. And it correlated, at least in terms of timing, with fragmentation of the media. First, you had the TV dial go from 4 channels to 40. Then you had the deregulation of radio and the rise of talk radio and the end of the equal time and fairness doctrines in media regulation of broadcasting. Then you had the internet. So we've gone from, in 1980, Michael Deaver said that if you reached 7 news outlets in the country, you had reached the American people.
We'll have more with Tom Rosenstiel, David French, and Brooke Gladstone after the break. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the media climate in light of the recent assault on a reporter by Montana Republican Greg Gianforte and other incidents of journalists getting roughed up while reporting on the government, and questions about our current media climate and what it says about our current media climate. We're joined by Tom Rosenstiel, Executive Director of the American Press Institute, David French, Senior Fellow at the National Review Institute and a Senior Writer for the National Review, and Brooke Gladstone, Host and Managing Editor of On the Media. And just before the break, Tom Rosenstiel, I had to interrupt you there. Did you want to finish your thought about the decentralization of news?
Yeah. So the decline in trust it correlates in terms of timing with what's the fact that we have so many more outlets. And a couple of things happen with that. One is that as you move from 4 to 4,000 or 10,000 outlets, each of them is vying for audience using different values. So you begin to splinter into ideological affinity groups as a way of marketing your news media. You know, when we had one cable news channel, it did not try and operate ideologically. When we had 6 national channels, 3 on cable,
It made sense for Fox to begin to do that, and then it made sense for MSNBC begin to have success when it began to emulate that on the left. When you look at the trust numbers, Republicans are the most distrustful of the press, conservatives are. The group that is the second most distrustful of the press are millennials. And these are people who grew up in this fragmented media landscape who really never saw the sort of Walter Cronkite rectitude era of the oligarchical press and have only seen press that have appealed to people in a more fragmented and segmented way. That's a significant problem. And now we have, in social media, you have people's news consumption is basically broken from brand. I move from story to story. One's pictures of my friend's grandkids, and the next is a news story. And the cues that I see are who shared it and what's it about. And who produced it is actually a tertiary indicator of whether I might want to read it or not.
But Tom Rosenstiel, take that a little bit further. Why is it bad? It may seem obvious, but explain to our listeners why it's bad that there is this erosion of the press's position in society, I guess.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is when the press felt this enormous responsibility of a mass audience, it actually reflected what Brick was arguing before about a kind of establishment cautious. The last guy to basically cast doubt over Vietnam was Walter Cronkite in 1968, 5 years after the New York Times had won a Pulitzer Prize for doubting the winnability of the Vietnam War. Cronkite, with this mass audience, felt a great responsibility to be cautious. Now, you are vying for attention in what scholars call the attention marketplace, waving your arms, and trying to build an audience, often not through sort of rectitude and caution, but through something different. The other element is that as we fragment as audiences, we're in a space where we only hear people who we agree with and whose views, if anything, may be more extreme than ours. So we don't have – now, this is not true on every subject. In sports, we gather at ESPN and we gather as a conjoined or, a group, at least of sports fans, when it comes to weather and traffic and even some local news. But when it comes to national politics, I've looked at this data very carefully over many years. It's really hard to argue with the idea that we have not sort of retreated to our own spaces.
Well, we're getting a lot of comments from listeners. This listener writes, the news media have played a counterproductive role against America's democratic system, where elections are bought and sold by big money with fake news and false propaganda. Fox News, together with the New York Times, Judith Miller, brought us George W. Bush and his agenda of massive invasion across the Middle East. The same despicable media groups gave Donald Trump billions of dollars in free ads and fake news about Hillary Clinton. And Felix writes, I consider myself open-minded, but I don't even trust you, KQED. What do you think that says for the rest of the media? And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the panelists what their thoughts were on how the news is presented given the impact of the funders, whether it's commercials on the old-style analog TV or even in public media with underwriting. In fact, it surprises me that Living on Earth has done so many terrific shows on climate change, and the funding is from Chevron. And I just wanted to know what their thoughts were on the impact of the funders on what gets put on the air.
Brooke Gladstone, do you want to take that?
Sure. My life in public media is such that the influence is probably greater from foundations than it is from corporate funders. There is a pretty strict wall between the editorial and the development staffs of most shows. I think a show like Living on Earth would bend over backwards not to show fealty to the interests of its funders. And, even when, say, Slate, which is a for-profit enterprise, was covering the Microsoft trial and was owned by Microsoft, it did a very aggressive job. I think that that isn't true of every single media outlet. There are plenty of examples of people who, of newspapers, especially local newspapers, that were dependent on car dealership ads, not to do negative reviews of particular cars or certain kinds of exposés. It definitely happens. I think that, you know, Disney and ABC may have had, you know, certain issues from time to time. I think that when the media pulls punches, it probably has to do more with wanting to avoid costly lawsuits, even if they know they could win. I think that the funding does not directly affect editorial all that much. I think that the interests of the owner may certainly affect newspapers, but that's a slightly different story.
Can I just add one point?
Yes.
And that is the conventional sort of wisdom, at least the sort of structural view, was the more funders you have, the less any one of them can have an undue influence. So actually, commercial advertising, as Brooke said, if you had scores of advertisers, you were pretty insulated. And I certainly worked at a newspaper where the Car Dealer Trade Association tried to have me fired. I was the business editor, and the publisher said, you know, they're gonna threaten to take their ads away. They will take their ads away for a couple weeks, and then they'll come back because, you know, they need us. And that's what happened. It is much more challenging if you're at a small startup, nonprofit news organization. You've got two or three funders, and one of them represents 60% or 70% of your foundation revenue. Then you really need to have courage and be very upfront with them about, you know, what the rules of the road are.
Well, let me thank Ruthann for the question. And David French, can I get some thoughts from you on how we improve the situation or how we improve this media climate?
Well, you know, I'm going to beat the same drum a little bit and say, it's not just about media, just as it's not just about Trump. It's also about audience. And we have to face a pretty uncomfortable fact, and that is that people like to hear what makes them feel better about what they already believe. And what the fragmentation of the media has allowed people to do is to find a very comfortable cocoon within that fragmentation and then mistrust everybody else. And this is something, I think that is a failure. Not just certainly there's media who cater to that, and you see that all the time. And one of the things I think that's every bit as influential, if not more influential than funding, is audiences. You're not much of a media figure if you have no audience. And so people tend to cater. There's a powerful pressure to find your audience and cater to your audience. And the audience loves to be catered to. And so this goes far deeper than looking at, okay, this individual media outlet or that individual media outlet, saying, what can you do to do better? And I tend to believe that, you know, some of our most prestigious outlets like the New York Times and Washington Post can do better. But we also have to reckon with the fact that people like to hear what reinforces what they believe. In a fragmented media environment, they're going to be able to find it, squat in that little cocoon, and condemn everybody else. And unless we get out of our bubble and decide to get out of our bubble, it's just going to get worse.
So, Tom,
can I endorse that?
Brooke Gladstone,
well,
sure.
I could not agree more. That was sort of the fundamental theme of the little pamphlet that I wrote, The Trouble with Reality. But I believe that we get the media we deserve. Like, we get the government we deserve. We weren't paying attention. That's part of the reason why. Or we narrowed our attention so to such a soda straw that that's part of the reason why. Or we didn't put our money or our efforts where we say our interests were, and that was part of the reason why. I've spent my entire life seeing the media as a scapegoat. There's plenty to complain about with the media. But what are you doing to support the media that you really, really need? When do you look outside of your comfort zone? And everything he said is absolutely true.
And Tom Rosenstiel, So we've talked a lot about how do we as journalists try to, you know, poke a hole in some of these bubbles, right? So that journalists can be heard, especially those who are really trying to present information that will help people make informed decisions about those in power.
Well, I mean, there's no simple answer to that, but the first answer is you report really amazing facts. Even when Obama did a lot to try and evade the press, and like most presidents, and not have a lot of press conferences, and not face a lot of tough questions sometimes, and then an ancient news organization, a newspaper, printing ink on paper would have a heck of a story, and suddenly it was enormously relevant, and everybody was talking about what they were talking about. So the first step is to have indispensable reporting, particularly reporting that really gets at important things and that no one else has. Now, harder to do than it sounds, but we're seeing actually a lot of that. It also engenders more leaking. I mean, if a newspaper, you take the Secret Service scandal that the Washington Post broke during the Obama administration, you know, you work those sources, you find out problems in Secret Service, then there are other stories that come along. You know, great reporting begats better sourcing, and it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a positive way. There's a virtuous circle there. I think a part of that, frankly, in a fragmented world, is probably that these news organizations need to get better at a few things rather than being in a department store that is mediocre at everything. So if you're the Washington Post, you've got to put down a few bets. We're going to really cover government and politics well, and maybe we're not going to cover the culture of the West as well as we once aspired to. If you're the New York Times, you're going to have to put down a few bets. And if you're a local metro or you're a local television station, all the more so. And then you have an ecosystem where we where news organizations see each other as not entirely competitors, but probably collaborators in an ecosystem where I can pick up things that you've reported and you can pick up things that I've reported, and you're in a sense soldiers in an army of truth, rather than seeing each one as its own independent operator that would never ever echo something that had been. I mean, when I was at the LA Times, we prided ourselves on never having any wire stories. Every story was written by a staffer, and we basically never attributed anything to anybody else because we always re-reported it. We're way past those days.
Well, let's hear from Linda in Napa. Hi, Linda.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First thing, I just wanted to say thank you to Brooke Gladstone. On the Media is absolutely one of the best programs consistently week in, week out, that I think is aired on NPR or any other station. So thank you.
Thank you.
Secondly, I guess I wanted to bring up Fox News in particular. I have a journalism background, and I studied journalism in graduate school. We studied ethics as part of our journalism training. I don't know where all that's gone in the world of journalism, but ethics is absolutely a critical component of proper journalism. And when Fox News came on the scene, it seems to me that it was about propagating lies and propagating agendas.
Well,
it really changed the face of journalism. And I've never really noticed that aspect of Fox News has actually been reported on. It seems to me so many people take all of their news from Fox News. It's really unhinged the society.
Well, Linda, you are not alone in your concerns about Fox News. Tom writes, just like district gerrymandering, there's been a concerted effort to imitate a grassroots effort to discredit the free press, culminating in the imitation and spoiling of it by Fox and Breitbart, etc. And Dave asks, what about Fox News and their take on current events and politics? They have the largest television audience. Are they influencing the political discourse to reflect Trump's disposition? David French, what do you think is the role of Fox News in all of this?
Well, I'm always asking which part of Fox News you're talking about. So if you're talking about Brett Baier and his team, those guys are good journalists. They are doing outstanding work. I mean, there's some people at Fox News who are just flat out excellent. If you're talking about the unlamented, at least in my mind, departure of Bill O'Reilly, or if you're talking about Sean Hannity's recent conspiracy mongering of this reprehensible Seth Rich nonsense, well, then I'm in enthusiastic agreement that that's absurd and corrosive to our public discourse. I think that Fox News is sort of a shorthand. It has become a scapegoat far beyond its actual influence on American public discourse. I think that what a Sean Hannity or a Bill O'Reilly are reflective of in many ways is they're very powerful, more conservative or populist voices who, on their own, and have their own responsibility for becoming toxic presences and toxic influences. And that's something that I think the one of the problems that there has existed in the conservative movement is there's been an unwillingness to confront that, and maybe not even a full realization of how bad it was until we saw it emerge more fully in the last year to 18 months. So, yeah, I kind of dislike the notion that Fox News is to blame when we're talking about an institution comprised of people, and those people do very different things within that institution. So I would say Brett Baier is a positive influence on our media and our discourse. I would say Bill O'Reilly was not. And so that's how I would analyze it. And to be clear, that kind of toxic personality that you see is in no way confined to the right, and mm-hmm. in no way confined to Fox News. One of the aspects of negative polarization that we see is both sides really hate and fear each other in many profound ways. They describe each other with similar derogatory terms when you look at the Pew data. And that comes from somewhere. I'm not somebody who's much in the business of saying, well, both sides are equally to blame. There are many circumstances where one side is more to blame than the other. But I'm unwilling to just sort of say, wave my hand at Fox News and say, well, that's the problem.
Well, how much would you lay at the feet of national media like the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, NPR even?
I would be my main problem, because one of the things that as I've gotten older, I've had more of an opportunity to interact with journalists at all of those places, and I really have not seen this conspiracy mindset that you often see articulated on the right, that CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, they're just out to get conservatives. I see a lot of people who are trying to do a good job who are almost always on the left, and then therefore don't necessarily see the world in the same way that they would see it if they had more conservative colleagues. And I think that's an institutional problem, but I don't think it's one where – I don't think it's malice aforethought. One of the ironic things to me is the fury directed at the New York Times recently when there was this explosive scoop about the existence of the Comey memos and description of their contents. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was not only the same paper, but the same reporter who helped break the Clinton email story, which was arguably the story that stopped the Hillary Clinton presidency. So to say the New York Times is somehow always wrong, the New York Times is always a malevolent anti-conservative actor, I think is just fundamentally false. I have a different thought about the Academy, but that's for another show.
David French is a senior writer for the National Review. We're also talking with Tom Rosensteel of the American Press Institute and Brooke Gladstone of On the Media. One of the things, Brooke Gladstone, that David French was talking about reminds me of something that you were saying in terms of how we improve the situation, which is really to look at the experiences that lead people to construct certain realities in the way that they do.
Right. We know that we're wired to do precisely what David described, which is to construct echo chambers or just to construct bubbles. I mean, the world is altogether too complex for us to grasp in its entirety, right? We would be paralyzed by it. And I think most of our head work is done much more on filtering out inconvenient information than it is on actually integrating it. We like our universes to be coherent. This is something that was very thoroughly described by Walter Lippmann back in the 20s. We just have to use these shortcuts. Stereotypes is what he called them, and it's the way we use it today, to figure out how the world works. And then when our notion of how the world works blows up, then we find ourselves in a terrible state of existential crisis. And I think that for many people, the people who didn't vote for Trump, there is that sense that the anxiety goes far beyond simply the election of a president you didn't want or an election. We've all had that. Live long enough, you're bound to have lots of presidents you didn't like and politics that you can't stand. But it isn't about that. It really seems to have shaken a lot of people to their foundation. And I think that unless we figure out how to reach out, I mean, you know, David writes for the National Review. The National Review is a place to go for views that are unlike your own. Perhaps if you are a liberal and you can get exposed to some of that thinking. I think a lot of people make the mistake of going to the most extreme view on the other side so that they can discount the view with ease, because that's much more comfortable than being confronted with some reasoning or some information that may not thoroughly fit into the world you've constructed. So I think you take baby steps out, not necessarily to change your point of view, but just to understand what the hell is going on out there.
Well, let's hear from Philip in San Francisco.
You're welcome.
Philip in San Francisco, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Willie Brown had a column in the Sunday column in the Chronicle recently in which he was addressing some African-Americans who were potential political persons. And he said his first advice was listen to everyone. Judy Woodruff interviewed John Kasich about his new book recently, and he said he thinks that people should read, possibly listen to, at least 10 minutes of viewpoints of those of others. Also, I want to criticize Michael Krasny and the moderators for many shows. Oftentimes, they invite only one person with a very liberal point of view. This is even Chris Matthews, Rachel Maddow, other people. They don't invite people with opposite views. So, and even your guest today, I think that you folks should answer the questions as quickly as possible so you can get more callers, because the last part of the show is for callers to speak, not for you folks to speak, to dominate the conversation.
Well, Philip, your feedback has been noted, so let me get another call. Tom in San Francisco. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. You know, I just find it curious. I think a lot of this, and I kind of go back to Reagan when he was governor, I think a lot of it has to do with dumbing down the culture and this whole emphasis on opinion versus fact. I don't care what the judgment base is, liberal or conservative. I think it's more just fact, and that's what journalism. That's the importance of journalism, and that is, you know, is giving people the facts. And when they start slamming it and they go into this opinion, fake news, I mean, to me, that's just fascism. I mean, we've seen this down through history, and they can spin it any way they want to and apply liberal or conservative to it. Whatever, it's basically people are being threatened because their viewpoint is, you know, it's not their viewpoint's being threatened, and so they'll lie any which way they want to get, you know.
Well, Tom, thank you for your point. I do want to try to squeeze in at least one more call from Don in San Jose. Don, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yes. First of all, I would like to say that Brooke Gladstone and On the Media is my favorite show. Listen to it every time.
A lot of love, Brooke.
I want to add to her points, and I think to say something that's been said many times before, is that we need to focus on the facts, that we as progressives need to listen to the conservatives, such as Charles Murray in his recent book, Coming Apart, much hated by most progressives, but the fact is that he is pointing out data that that we should pay attention to. In his particular case, he's talking about the younger, lower middle class as being less employed and having lower marriage rates and other issues that he points out as having a bad effect on society. I disagree totally with his remedies, but we need to listen to or disagree with his facts.
Don, thank you. Thank you for that. We have just a little bit of time left. Andy writes, the media remains the only check our society has on government corruption. The fact it has, as an industry, managed to mostly squander the public's understanding of that irreplaceable role in our republic is a crying shame. And all I have to say to those in the media who wring their hands is, physician, heal thyself. And Noel writes, politicians need to learn how to deal with annoying reporters. It's part of our democracy. Well, I'd like to thank Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media from WNYC, who has a new book, The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. Thanks, Brooke Gladstone.
Thank you.
And thank you, David French, senior fellow at the National Review Institute and a senior writer for the National Review. And thanks, Tom Rosenstiel, executive director of the American Press Institute and author of the novel Shining City. Thanks so much for being here this morning. Thanks to our listeners for their thoughts, their calls and comments. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.